with it, you can get in touch with us, and we'd love to bring you on.
Volunteering at CJSF 90.1 FM is a great experience and is easy to get started. So I'll tell you a little bit about it in the hope that you reach out. As this station is run almost entirely by volunteers, you have a variety of ways to get active at CJSF. Every department can use a little bit of help. Arts and entertainment. Well, you can write and produce reviews, conduct interviews of local musicians, the music library, acquiring, organizing, reviewing, and compiling charts. Public affairs. Interviewing groups, attending events, recording lectures. Public relations, postering, graphic design, and programming. You can host your own show or work on a collective. Production, audio editing, and PSA building. And once you feel comfortable, you can even volunteer to help the volunteers. So volunteer with us at CJSF 90.1. Email us at vol4cjsf@sfu.ca.
And now for a CJSF Heritage Minute. During the 80s and the 90s, CJSF would come into its own as a serious platform for independent artists and a forum for people to express ideas not present in the mainstream media. Summer 2002, CJSF receives a license from the Canadian Radio Telecommunications Commission to broadcast over the FM airwaves. February 13th, 2003, 7 p.m. CJSF goes on air at 90.1 FM, and we've been changing the sound of radio in Burnaby ever since.
Once again, you are listening to Speak Up only on CJSF 90.1 FM. That was our interview with Kimberly Phillips, the executive director of SFU Galleries, and the newly opened Marianne and Edward Gibson Art Museum here at SFU Burnaby, which is now open to the public and is free admission. Coming up next, we have another piece that I recently did. This is an interview with United Way BC, specifically their strategic initiatives manager, Trisha Dulku, on a vulnerable demographic here in BC and across Canada, post-secondary students who are currently facing higher rates of food insecurity, specifically post-secondary students who have previously been in government care. Take a listen. This is Danny Nezvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. United Way BC has recently brought attention to an underrepresented demographic in the province currently facing increasing rates of food insecurity. Post-secondary students who have previously been in government care. To help address this issue, United Way BC has released the Youth Futures Education Fund, which, as stated by United Way, provides low barrier access to funds for basic living expenses like food, rent, tech, childcare, and more. CJSF reached out to United Way BC for an interview in order to learn more about the fund, as well as the issue it aims to address. We got in contact with Trisha Dulku, United Way's Strategic Initiatives Manager, who spoke with us about the findings from a recent TD survey that present growing levels of food insecurity among post-secondary students, and thus the need for the Youth Futures Education Fund.
Yeah, so that TD survey, the new one, it does show that majority of Canadian post-secondary students, 92%, are stressed about money. And there have been a lot of studies done focused on specific institutions as well, even within BC, talking about how food insecure students are. Now, this particular priority population that we're focused on with the Youth Futures Education Fund are youth who've been in government care. So for those of your listeners who don't understand what that term is of government care, essentially it means that these are youth who've been in the foster care system for a period of their life growing up. So they didn't necessarily have the stability of family, that stable home. Oftentimes they might have been kind of going from home to home without having that sense of security that many of us would have, particularly those of us who are familiar with, you know, a nuclear family lifestyle. And so what happens is that when they turn 19, they age out. And when they age out, they lose access to any of their foster care parents or caregivers that they were connected to. They lose access to any of those support workers that are available to them through the Ministry of Children and Family Development. And they're essentially just handed their birth certificates and told good luck. So they're out on their own. And so when they're And these are kids, these are young people who really want to pursue their futures. You know, they have dreams, they have hopes, like all other young people. They want to get a good job, they want to start their own families. But it's so hard when you don't have that stability of support that you can lean on. And even though there is the BC government's tuition waiver program, which does waive the cost of tuition as well as mandatory fees for a lot of these young people, it's still, and I'm sure you know this, when you're going to school, it's not just about the tuition. There's the cost of rent, making sure you have a roof over your head. There's the cost for food and groceries. And now more than ever, those costs are climbing as well. Sometimes there's the need for really expensive textbooks or particular school supplies. Or even, you know, given some of the hard situations that some of these young people have dealt with being in the care system, maybe there's like a triggering situation that can come up where they suddenly need to access mental health and counseling supports. And so what the Youth Futures Education Fund does is it provides these young people with that supplemental funding support for all of these needs so that they can really just pursue their studies and have that stability.
Dulku then discussed the need for further community and government investment for students facing food insecurity.
I think whenever different organizations, institutions, parts of our community come together to support our young people, then that's a good thing, because then it can really help make sure that it provides that stable, that spine, that support that these folks need so they can really learn to stand on their own two feet. And when these are young people that we should be investing in, because at the end of the day, they're our future, right? They're the ones who are going to be working, building up, and part of the workforce. They're the ones who are going to be paying into CPP and all of those kinds of programs that, folks who are getting older will be needing support, and they're the ones who are going to be that front line. And so anytime we can invest in these young people, and I don't just mean United Way, all parties across the board, government institutions, even in the private sector, corporate entities, when we're investing in our young people, it's a good investment because it's going to pay dividends for us all down the line.
Next, some of the stories that United Way BC has been hearing from post-secondary institutions regarding food insecurity on campus.
There are a lot of stories that we've heard over the years, especially since this fund was, the YFEF fund was first put together in 2015. I can tell you that most recently, we've been hearing more and more from our partners at all of the public post-secondary institutions about the food insecurity that their staff are witnessing right on campus. I'll give you an example. So just a few months ago, we heard a report about a student attending a university that's based on Vancouver Island who has been in government care and is pursuing their studies there, but they were found to be dumpster diving for essentials that they needed on campus. And so these are the kinds of situations that we really want to mitigate with the Youth Futures Education Fund, because it's important for young people to have the agency that they need, as well as the dignity of choice when it comes to those essentials that they absolutely need. And we don't want youth to feel like they're having to be in survival mode when they're just trying to study and get ahead in life. We really want them to thrive so that they can access all those supports that they need.
Lastly, Trisha Dulku reaffirmed the importance of the Youth Futures Education Fund as a way of aiding students who have previously been in government care.
I mean, I'll give you another case in point. We had a young person that's attending an institution in northern BC, and they were evicted from the home that they were sharing with a couple other youth who've also been in care. And so the three of them were looking for stable housing, which was very hard to find close to campus that was affordable. One of the things that YFEF did was ensure that they had access to funds very quickly in a very low barrier manner so that they can quickly secure a living space, including the cost for a damage deposit. And that's one of the things as well, is that when you're living paycheck to paycheck, or you're really relying on high interest debt like credit cards to try and take care of you in emergencies or unexpected situations, that in itself can be very emotionally draining. And so with YFEF, it's really vital for that that fund to be available, especially for these unexpected and emergent situations too.
Once again, that was our conversation with Trisha Dulku, the Strategic Initiatives Manager for United Way BC, on the Youth Futures Education Fund, which aims to serve post-secondary students, and in particular, post-secondary students who have previously been in government care, who are facing issues such as food insecurity. This has been Danny Nazvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca. We are back with Speak Up only on CJSF 90.1 FM. This is Danny Nazvedarani, your community journalist, and I recently attended a news event that served as an update to the Metro or Greater Vancouver 2025 homelessness count. And this was an event that had some representatives from various organizations speaking on these new updates, as well as specific requests for municipalities and the provincial government in order to address these issues, because unfortunately the findings of this homeless count are quite bleak. There were various speakers there to speak about these findings, including Jenna Berg, a member of the Indigenous Homeless Steering Committee for Greater Vancouver, for Reaching Home, and Lauren Kopis, the chair of the Greater Metro Vancouver Community Advisory Board for Reaching Home. First to speak at the event was Jenna Berg, who provided some updates on how homelessness and precarious housing situations specifically affect the Indigenous populations of the Greater Vancouver area.
So as we begin, let us be clear, housing is a human right. And First Nation, Métis, and Inuit people have a right to stay in that home. I'm here today as a member of the Indigenous Homelessness Steering Committee, asked to help share the findings of the 2025 Indigenous Homelessness Count. The report is not just data, it's a sacred bundle of stories, shared with us in trust by 1,068 people of Indigenous ancestry. Our organization holds the responsibility to listen with respect, honor that trust, and amplify the request. We already know about the overrepresentation of Indigenous people in the unhoused population. This year, the count shows 38% of respondents identified as Indigenous, compared with 2% of the census population. This year, the count also shows that things are not getting better. Since 2023, there's been a 30% increase in Indigenous unhousing. This can't continue. This is something we cannot accept. The report tells us that the realities of being unhoused are directly tied to the ongoing legacy of colonialism. The findings are 68% of Indigenous respondents have a history with the residential school system. 51% have a history with the foster care system. And so these are not just numbers. They're the root cause that result in Indigenous people being over 16% times or 16% more likely to experience unhousing today. Indigenous people become unhoused at a younger age, stay unhoused for longer, and are more likely to be unsheltered than non-Indigenous people. The role for you as allies and as partners is to listen, to learn, and to share and support this work. Therefore, our call to action today is directed at all levels of government. We must follow Indigenous leadership. We must urge leaders to declare housing as a human right and to enact that right through policies that focus on and fund Indigenous-led and culturally appropriate housing and services. The people who have shared their truths have given us their trust in their stories. They have told us what they need. Our collective duty is to walk the path with them in support of self-determination until safety and dignity have a place to call home. Thank you.
Next, to speak on the rest of the findings for the 2025 Greater Vancouver Homeless Count was Lorraine Copus.
Thank you. I'm the chair of the Reach Home Community Advisory Board that works on the non-Indigenous stream. And together, we've put together the picture of homelessness here in Metro Vancouver. I think as Gina spoke, it drew to my mind the importance of the motion that is in front of UBCM today, and that is to establish housing as a human right. Earlier, when we presented the results of the count, we knew that there were 5,232 people who were experiencing homelessness in the 2025 count, and that this was up from the previous count by about 9%. But we also knew that the whole growth was in the street homelessness, people who have absolutely nowhere to go and no roof over their head at all, not even the sheltered homeless. That number is 1,893 people. And when you look at those numbers and the growth in that number, you start to see that systems are really failing. But as society, we're also failing to recognize that housing should be a human right. Gina spoke beautifully of the Indigenous story and the fact that Indigenous people are overrepresented in the homeless count, but also among the street homeless. They make up 40% of those who are without a place to call home, who are among the street homeless. I'll provide some of the other demographics, and that would include by age. So if we look at youth homelessness, the number of youth in this count was actually down from the previous homeless count, but you're still looking at 172 people who were 25 years or younger who are on the street. And if you look at the full report, you'll see that the majority of people, almost the majority, 46% of everyone who was homeless had first become homeless as a youth. So you start to see the pattern that as systems fail people, people fail more and more, and they don't need to fail. If you look at those who are 25 to 54 years old, the count now says we have 2,171 people. That's 72% of all the people in the count, and that number is also up from 1,820 in the previous count. So you just start to see more and more how people are falling behind and struggling. Seniors are an important demographic. They now make up 22% of all people in the count, and that's 677 seniors, 55 and older. Previously, seniors would be eligible for social housing at that age and would likely have a place over their head, but as Canada pulled back on housing supply programs, you start to see now more and more seniors who just simply can't make it. Page 33 of the report actually shows the trend of all of these groups, and it's an important picture to look at. The age people first experienced homelessness, as I said, as a youth was 46% was as a youth. For seniors, actually 47%, the first time becoming homeless was as a senior. And so when we look at some of the patterns and trends underneath the data, it starts to paint that picture of our systems are failing. Our housing system is no longer providing housing that meets the needs of the people who live in our communities. Another important stat within the count is that the majority of people were from their home community. So there's this idea that people travel from place to place in order to secure housing. It's not the case. They're losing their housing in their home community. They're staying among family, friends, and their networks, but they've lost their chance to have that safe place that they can call home. If you look at the gender of those who are homeless, men still make up the majority of people who are homeless. 67% of those in the most recent homeless count were men. Women, however, now count for 1 in 3 of people in the count, and that number is continuing to go up. In the last count, there were 977 women who were now experiencing homelessness here in Metro Vancouver, from 718 previously. And you'll start to see individuals from different gender diverse backgrounds also experiencing homelessness, with the question that was added to the count on sexual orientation showing that 1 in 10 people who were identified in the count do not identify as heterosexual. There's also important data on the length of time that people are experiencing homelessness. This was a number I started to track years ago, because when I first started to do this work, I felt it was horrible that about 50% of the people who were in the count had been without a place to live for more than a year. But the count, that number is now up to 75%. So 75% of the people in the last count reported that they had been without a place to live for a year or more. And it was higher among the unsheltered. So I think as you start to look at the data and then start to pull out some of the stories beneath the data, you can start to see a picture that speaks to why we should all be stepping into that space to talk about housing as a human right and what it means about living without a place that you can actually call your home. There was some new data added to this year's count, and one was just to look at the question of chronic homelessness, and that was because the federal government has a commitment to reduce chronic homelessness, and we understand that we're all falling behind across all levels of government, but the data within the report asked about the last 3 years, how many people have been without a place to live for a year or more, and over 3 years, and over half said that they had been without a place to live, with the number again being higher among the unsheltered. Health is a factor, mental health is a factor, substance use is a factor, but it's all of these factors coming together that create the pathway that pushes people into homelessness. If you look at it, 43% of those who were interviewed on the night of the count would have reported a medical condition. 33% it was a physical disability. A number would also report mental health and substance use, with a concurrent disorder on that being 54%. Again, it shows up in the patterns of service use, but again, the most frequent need among those who were interviewed was actually food, and the need for food security. Nutritious, healthy food might not even be an option for anyone who's in the count, but at least basic sustenance. You also then see a lot of health needs combined within that patterns of service use, and the infographic that has been prepared shows a really good picture of all the different types of needs. Income shows that many receive income assistance, but that it's not enough, and that people really are doing the best that they can to provide through many different methods of income. I think that for me, I'm just going to figure out where I am in my whole story. For me, I'm down to the last part, which is the reason for people being homeless. And one of the new questions was actually around eviction. And people, 44%, reported that they were now without a place to live because they had been evicted. And it immediately comes to mind, well, what is that? 44% was pure economic eviction. They could no longer afford. 28% said they'd had conflict with their landlord. And again, when you look at the supercharged housing market that we're in here, often there is even the rent eviction piece I would expect going on, where if you can have someone leave the housing that they're in, you can reprice, because we have vacancy decontrol regulation here in BC. So it is even an incentive for landlords to move people on if the rents are lower or more affordable. But the human and social consequences that are showing up in the data. for the seniors, a lot of it was economic eviction.
Once again, you were just listening to Jenna Berg and Lorraine Kopis speak on some of the pretty stark findings from the most recent update to the 2025 Vancouver homeless count. And, you know, some things in there that I was not aware of is just the significant impact that this issue is having on senior populations, on people that are already employed. You know, I think this is quite a far-reaching issue within the greater Vancouver area, and I hope that further awareness and advocacy around this issue hopefully not only puts that support towards things like mental health and areas such as that, but also to just building more housing for those that need it and more affordable housing for those that need it. Again, this has been Danny Nesvedarani, your host for the hour. For this hour of Speak Up, we have reached the very end of today's episode, but I want to thank you all so much for tuning in. And before we end off, I'm going to be playing a song from Sour Dope, a band that is quite well loved here at the station. This is their track Water Temple. Again, thank you for listening to this hour of Speak Up, and make sure you stay tuned, because right at 11 a.m. we have none other than Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. Once again, Sour Dope, Water Temple, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. Thank you for tuning in.